Good evening. This is a Monday night edition of Ozarks at Large for Monday, May 11th, 2020. Thanks for being with us tonight. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead this evening, we begin a series of conversations with locally owned businesses here that occupy a niche in the retail market. Find out how they're making it through this historic economic pause. Tonight, Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek finds out how Pure Joy Ice Cream in Siloam Springs is doing these days. Our first Business as Unusual segment begins in about 10 minutes tonight on Ozarks at Large. After our show this evening, we continue to bring you a live national conversation about the latest regarding the pandemic and resulting economic shutdown. The Hour is a production of All Things Considered at NPR and begins at 8. We know things are a bit different for you right now, your schedule, your children's schedule, your routine, and hearing the stories, interviews, and information about where you live featured on Ozarks at Large at 7 p.m. and noon every Monday through Friday isn't always easy. So we've made our podcast available for free through services like Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and other places where podcasts are hosted. You can also tell your smart speaker to play Ozarks at Large. And we can also have daily highlights delivered right to your email inbox. We have a free Ozarks at Large daily newsletter, complete with links to the stories about health, economics, arts, music, and more that we present every day. You can subscribe right now at KUAF.com/newsletter. The cumulative number of COVID-19 cases in Arkansas is now above 4,000. Dr. Nate Smith, Arkansas's Secretary of Health, says midday calculations put the number of cases at 4,043, with 94 deaths connected to the virus in Arkansas, and just over 800 cases considered active in the state. He says in the 48 hours between midday Friday and today's press briefing, 59 new cases were reported. There are 61 people in Arkansas hospitals right now due to complications from COVID-19. And today marks another step the state is allowing toward limited business reopenings as restaurants choosing to do so can host dine-in services at no more than one-third capacity and with several regulations. Today also allows medical facilities to move to another level of elective surgeries, as discussed at Friday's press briefing. Dr. Nate Smith says he also wants Arkansans to understand that doctor's appointments for non-COVID-19 conditions are important.
I had a conversation with my father and mother-in-law over the weekend. My father-in-law had an appointment scheduled for this morning, but they were afraid to go to see his primary care doctor because they were afraid of getting COVID-19 or that he would go and bring it back to her. And, you know, that's an important conversation. So we sat down and talked about the things, the precautions that are being taken, and how much our hospitals, our clinics have done to prevent the spread of COVID-19, and how it was important that he go to that appointment. And I was very encouraged when I left this morning to see that he and my mother-in-law had gone to the appointment this morning. So very encouraged. But it's going to take us getting back into confidence, going and unfortunately there are people who have suffered medical conditions completely unrelated to COVID-19 because they've been afraid to go to their clinic or to the hospital. And as those facilities have done such a good job of preventing the spread of COVID-19, we need to encourage ourselves and each other to get the care that we need.
As steps toward reopening continue, Governor Asa Hutchinson says Arkansas is in a relatively good position to slowly resume economic activity.
And yes, we took a hit, but it wasn't a nosedive as we've seen some other places. And I think the reason that we're in a good position to rebound quickly in Arkansas is because we didn't shut down our complete economy, but that we managed it and we minimized some of the hurt that was out there, even though our economy took a hit as well. But it's also the underlying fact of Arkansas's economy that is based upon a broad diversity.
Today's briefing was held in El Dorado in southern Arkansas. It's a city that took a significant economic blow last week when Murphy Oil announced it would leave its founding city and consolidate offices in Houston. Murphy USA, which has far more employees in El Dorado, will stay in the city. As he's done several times in the past 2+ months, the governor stressed the importance of social distancing and following regulations put in place by the state to make sure a recovery and reopening can continue. The governor says a scheduled concert at Temple Live in Fort Smith, a concert that, if it were staged, appears it would be the first in the country since the pandemic, does not fall in line with the state's guidelines for indoor venues. The concert has been announced to take place Friday, the 15th, 3 days before the governor's directive allowing indoor events to begin with limitations would allow for such events.
That violates our directives because we authorized those to be open on May 18th, and so that has not been approved. We've looked at their plan, and their plan was insufficient as well. So that concert does not have our approval, being 3 days before the authorized date, as well as a few other problems.
And Mike Preston, the state's Secretary of Commerce, says this week the state will issue over 100,000 unemployment insurance checks. He says the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program is now in operation. For people who had been out of work before the pandemic, this will allow for an additional 13 weeks of eligibility. And he says about 23,000 residents so far have applied for pandemic unemployment assistance claims. And he hopes the state, after checking eligibility, will be able to issue checks in the next couple of weeks. This is the system that would provide assistance for self-employed workers and members of the gig economy. The press briefing can be viewed in its entirety at the governor's YouTube channel. You can also follow developments at the COVID-19 update page at KUAF.com and through our weekday newscast with Antoinette Grajeda at 5:30 and 7:30 during Morning Edition. This is Ozarks at Large. The 2020 census is still underway, but the U.S. Census Bureau is adjusting its timeline because of the pandemic. Residents now have until October 31st to complete the census online, by phone, or by mail. A $5,000 grant from the National League of Cities is helping the city of Gravette collect more responses from residents. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke via Zoom with the city's mayor, Kurt Maddox, to learn more about what types of initiatives that grant will fund.
There was a grant available for smaller cities that had rural areas where people may be less likely to actually sign up and do it. And we looked at our totals from 2010 and realized that we only had a little over 68% who had actually done the get it done themselves without people having to go door to door and try to find out everybody. So we were trying to increase those numbers this year. And plus, we also found out that we have anywhere in our area between 20 and 35% of people who don't have internet service. And so we wanted to find a way that they could make it easy for them to be able to come in to City Hall or to the library or some other areas where we might set up the stuff we're going to get with this grant for them to be able to have an easy way to get their information in.
So what are some of the initiatives that you're looking to roll out with this grant?
Well, one, we're going to do some kiosks. Some will be have a couple of laptop computers and then also an iPad where people will be able to just come in. It'll already have access to internet for them. And we may even set up some areas where, like at a four-way stop and a tent for a day where they can just come in and we'll have a, you know, sign up, do your census here now, and they'll be able to just walk under there and we'll have it manned, and then, or we'll have a spot at the library. Everything will be set up for them. So all they have to come in is enter in either their name, address, and if they don't have their code, that also comes, of course, when they send out the packets to everybody.
When do you anticipate rolling this out? I know things have been complicated a little bit with social distancing during the pandemic.
Yeah, so they've moved things off a little bit. So our stuff is coming in, actually some stuff being delivered today. And then we will start working on a date as, you know, things open back up. We expect probably in June, from June on, we'll start having these kiosk options. As soon as our lobby's back open at City Hall, we'll be ready to go.
So what has the response rate been like so far for Gravit? Nationally, the response rate is around 57%. How does that compare to Gravit?
Yeah, we are right now at 56.1 as of this week. And Benton County is, I believe, the number one in Arkansas right now for response rate. And a lot of that's because us and other cities in Benton County are real strong on their Facebook. And we've been really hitting that hard every week to get the people who follow us on Facebook to go ahead and get it done for us.
Why are those responses so important for the city?
Well, as you may have heard, it's up to about $3,000 a year you could lose for each person that does not get counted. And over a 10-year period, since a census is only done once every 10 years, over a 10-year period, that's as much as $30,000 that won't go to your schools or to your roads or to other infrastructure and city and school stuff that needs to be done. So we want to make sure if there's any way possible to get every single person we can who's moving into town, who's moved in, who's just had a baby. I know that 5 and under is a big key that gets left out a lot. And so we're trying to also focus on education. We're also doing a mail or two to let people know what to expect and just kind of the information about them understanding that, you know, they're not being tracked specifically by name, that there's laws against that. And so that they know that it's not anything that's going to harm them or haunt them down or anything.
You mentioned that it could mean fewer responses could mean less money for projects for a school or for roads or things like that. Are there any specific projects like that that you could use as an example? So maybe that makes it a little more tangible for someone who's thinking about responding.
Yeah, for example, we get money that comes in each month from the state and county that is based on our population. So it's based on the anytime tax money comes in or is given out, we get based on our population on that too. And extra state money that comes in is also based on our population. So there's lots of things that come in based on population. So every single person that's counted, we either get more or lose more, especially in our street turnback. There's a lot in that that you don't want to have potholes. You want to have nice paved streets. Having your people counted helps significantly in that part.
What's the best way for people to keep up with when you're rolling out the kiosks and if they have more questions about the census and Gravit?
Yeah, so we will, of course, we'll do a mailer and let them know. We'll put it in the water bills and let people know. But Facebook is our big way we talk to everybody. In fact, in the state and even in the U.S., City of Gravit has one of the top Facebook numbers per capita of any city in the whole U.S. And most cities average about 20% of their population on their Facebook. And we actually have over 100% of our population on our Facebook page. So, of course, we're very active. We keep it going. And it's word spreads quick when people share stuff like that. So that's kind of how our focus is going to be to help inform them.
What else should we know?
So we're also sending stuff home in the snack packs with the school, and we've worked with the school to be able to do that so that especially in the lower income segment, they'll be able to get that and kids will be able to hand that to their parents in the snack packs that are going out with everybody. So that's pretty cool.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Yes, thank you.
That was Gravit Mayor Kurt Maddox. He spoke via Zoom with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda last week. More information about the city's census initiatives can be found at the City of Gravit Government Facebook page. On today's Ozarks, we're beginning a new series that we're calling Business as Unusual. We'll find out how owners of niche businesses are weathering this pandemic. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek kicks off the segment by taking us to an ice cream shop that straddles the Arkansas and Oklahoma border.
Matt Feierabend is the owner and ice cream creator at Pure Joy Ice Cream in downtown Siloam Springs.
We make our own ice cream from scratch if we have caramel in our ice cream, we made the caramel. If we have cookies in the ice cream, we make the cookies.
Fire Robin started the business about 8 years ago. First, he served up his ice cream treats at events and festivals. But 3 years ago, he took the leap and opened up a shop on Broadway Street.
And we have a decent distribution. We've got wholesale that we do to restaurants and grocery stores.
Around the time the coronavirus outbreak arrived in Arkansas about 2 months ago, Fire Robin and his wife were making a trip out to Colorado.
To a very unpopulated area of Colorado, 650 people in the town we were headed to, and we were going to do some backcountry skiing. If I can make money doing something else, I'd be backcountry skiing.
But then everything around them started shutting down, and Fire Robin says he realized the outbreak was making its way across the country faster than he originally thought.
So what I did was I just called my staff and I asked them, I said, hey, how's everybody feeling? We have, at the time and still right now, we have a team of three people. So we go from three employees in the winter to about 12 to 15 employees in the summer usually. We should easily have 6 to 8 employees right now, but we're still just hanging on to the three employees that we had when all of this started.
After speaking with those three employees, Fire Robin says he started making some drastic changes to the way Pure Joy normally operates to eliminate as many points of contact between staff and customers as possible.
We said, let's switch to people calling in their orders and curbside delivery to their cars. And so from Colorado, my wife and I jumped online and put together a quick website that people could order on.
He then asked his employees to take all the ice cream they had in gallon containers and start scooping it into small cups with lids.
And I just told him, I said, let's start packaging everything in those. And I placed a big order from our supplier. And I said, I need as many cups and lids as you can give me. And I think this is going to be what we're doing for a little while.
Fire Robin says they went through a range of ideas after that to adapt to a new normal that balanced the customer experience of Pure Joy with keeping those customers safe.
So we thought about completely rearranging our ice cream shop, like taking our ice cream freezer that we normally scoop out of and pushing it up front, up against the glass, so that potentially people could see in from the outside of the shop. We thought, is this going to be what we do for the next 6 months to a year? And we kind of balked at that idea because we would need to move plumbing maybe or electrical. And we were like, we're not ready to do that. We're gonna just do the cup.
Since then, Fire Robin says they've come up with other creative ways to get ice cream to as many people as possible, like daily deliveries in Siloam Springs.
So we do that. We do that once a day from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock. So if you get your order in before 5, we'll deliver it within 5 miles of our shop.
But a third of Pure Joy's overall customers are people who stop in on their way to somewhere else. So Fire Robin says they needed to figure out a way to expand their distribution, especially when he realized their sales dropped by 65%.
So we kind of had this realization that we needed to find a way to get our ice cream to people who were not going to make that trip, you know, who were going to stay in their homes. So we pretty quickly threw together another big change, which was offering a pint subscription.
A pint subscription allows customers who live in Northwest Arkansas and Northeast Oklahoma to get 3 pints of ice cream delivered to their door once a month.
And the crazy thing is, like, normally we put a lot of thought behind all of the little nuances of the business plan before launching it. And I think we gave ourselves about 3 days to work through what we thought would be the kinks.
Fire Robin says he's worked some 12 to 14 hour days lately, but his business has been able to recover about a third of the 65% of sales it lost at the start of the outbreak. Despite that, overall, Pure Joy has lost 40 to 50% of its business compared to this time last year.
We're trying to get a handle on all the numbers, but it really is so much to think about and deal with. And I'm also trying to ask my staff, you know, regularly once a week, we're doing meetings and saying, how do you guys feel about what we're doing? Do you feel safe?
And Fire Robin says he has to think about the future too. Normally, this is the time of year when the ice cream business ramps up and makes up for the slowdown that takes place during the winter months.
And I'm going, what is the effect this is going to have on our business next January? Because we make a lot of our money in the summer. We try to save that money to help us get through the winter. So I'm nervous. I'm going, what do we need to be doing right now to make sure that we can get through next winter as well?
Although the state is lifting dine-in restrictions on food establishments and bars, Fire Robin says he's planning to have a meeting with his staff later this week to figure out what that will look like at Pure Joy and when it'll actually happen.
I'm letting my staff kind of drive this because I know that there's a risk to them that they feel exposed. They're doing most of the interactions with the customers, and I'm doing a lot of the deliveries and production and all that. So I'm just listening to them and their voices. And I actually told them, I said, each one of you has the ability to veto a decision.
Fire Robin says not having other businesses in the area that operate like his to look to for guidance was a challenge.
At first, I felt a lot of pressure.
He says that pressure was brought on by watching friends who own restaurants completely close their establishments.
And one really close friend was like, hey, you know, I think he could kind of sense it in one of our conversations. And he said, hey, you have a totally different business. You're fine. Keep doing what you're doing. I think you're doing it safely. I think you're doing it responsibly.
And Fire Robin says he couldn't have done that without his staff, who have become a lot more involved in the decisions that are being made at Pure Joy.
I have learned that I didn't do enough listening to my staff in the past, that I've kind of always been the, like, this is my job to do, right? Like, as an owner, I felt that, like, I needed to make decisions. I shouldn't put decisions on my staff.
But these uncharted times, he says, have helped him change the way he interacts with his staff to create a more collaborative decision-making process, whether that decision concerns their safety during the outbreak or purchasing a yellow 1966 GMC handy van with some savings set aside for the business.
I went to my staff and I said, hey, you know, sales are down. I think this is going to continue. We have a couple of options. We can hold on to this money. It'll pay a month or two's worth of wages if everything hits the fan and, you know, sales plummet even further, or we can try and invest in a new idea to take ice cream to where people are at, to their homes, to their neighborhoods, and try to invest in some ways to safely serve ice cream still. We had that discussion and they all were like, go buy it. Go buy the van.
Fire Robin says when we're all on the other side of the pandemic, he plans to keep that collaborative spirit rolling. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
And Matt Fire Robin tells us his business did qualify for a Paycheck Protection Program loan in the first round of funding in the Federal CARES Act. He also received what many are calling an economic injury disaster grant. The Small Business Administration is offering an up to $10,000 advance as part of their new application process for economic injury disaster loans. Although it's being called an advance, it does not need to be repaid. This is Ozarks at Large, and joining me on the phone from his home is Randy Dixon, who is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy, it's Monday. Welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Now, on previous Pryor Center profiles, we've listened to Bill Clinton, Orville Faubus, music inspired by the Arkansas Razorbacks. I think this is our first one that's about a place.
And this is quite a place. It has quite a storied past. It is Fort Chaffee.
Right.
Which is right outside of Fort Smith. It was originally Camp Chaffee, and it was created in 1941 when the U.S. anticipated entering World War II. The government paid $1.35 million for more than 15,000 acres in northwest Arkansas. As a matter of fact, the first troops for training and housing arrived on December 7th, 1941, of all times.
Wow.
The day Pearl Harbor was attacked, yes. From 42 to 46, troops were trained there, but they also held 3,000 German prisoners of war. Then in 56, it became an Army Field Artillery Training Center and became a permanent facility, so they renamed it Fort Chaffee instead of Camp Chaffee.
Hmm. Something else happened in the late 50s that many people remember Fort Chaffee for.
It's actually most famous from March of 1958, when a guy named Elvis Presley, who was being inducted into the Army, spent 3 or 4 days there. But the most famous thing was that he got his Army buzz cut in the barber shop. And I think it was called The Haircut Heard Round the World.
Yep.
And there was apparently so much international press inside that you could not get into the barbershop, and they could barely get his hair cut. But after it was over, he was interviewed, and I believe his quote was, "Hair today, gone tomorrow."
And, of course, there is a museum that it still exists right there on the grounds where his haircut happened.
Yes, they've restored it, and it's building 803.
But it's no longer Fort Chaffee. I mean, the fort part of Fort Chaffee ended.
Yes, it was declared inactive in 1961 and was closed. Apparently there were quite a few or several federal facilities that were closed at that time. But Chaffee was definitely the largest, and, you know, it made quite an impact on the Fort Smith economy because there were so many troops there that would come into town and spend money. But at the time of the closing, then Governor Orville Faubus made some comments about that closing.
Well, the reason I'm not completely convinced at all that the closing of Chaffee's economy move is the information we get compared to other facilities there. These 30-some-odd facilities were listed. Some of them have 7 people, 14, 30, and so on. Well, those were practically closed out anyhow. And to place Camp Chaffee, Fort Chaffee, in the same category with them and make it appear that you're closing a large number of big facilities, it just doesn't add up. In fact, the information which the people had at Fort Smith when I was up there shows that Chaffee will have 50% of all the jobs that will be eliminated. All these others just amount to as many jobs as they have at Chaffee itself. So you can see that the others scattered around in the different places, that the closing of Chaffee hurt the Fort Smith area and Arkansas and Oklahoma far worse than the closing of any other one or several.
Governor Orville Faubus, who we profiled a few weeks ago during one of these segments, speaking about the closing of Fort Chaffee and Fort Smith. That was 1961.
So let's fast forward a few years. The base sort of sat dormant, was not used, was inactive, and in 1975, Chaffee was chosen as a relocation center for the Vietnamese refugees coming to America after the fall of Saigon. And according to this report from KATV's John Hudgens, the local residents were not too pleased.
Fort Smith, on the Arkansas-Oklahoma border in western Arkansas, has a population of some 60,000 people. It's in Sebastian County. It's located to a former military installation, Fort Chaffee. It is now closed. A long time ago, several years back, before that closing, people here, the 60,000 population, used to always talk about that closing. They didn't want it closed. But today they're talking about Fort Chaffee again. This time, they don't want it open for another reason. They don't necessarily want the refugees that may come. Officials in Fort Smith and Sebastian County are miffed this evening. They still have received no official word as to how many refugees might come, when they might come, or how long they might stay, or what type of program they will work under.
John Hudgens, who we've heard before on these segments, reporting from Fort Smith, and reporting on sort of the unease in Fort Smith about Vietnamese refugees that were coming. And really, that culture has been a vibrant part of Fort Smith since.
Yes, absolutely. And let's bring in another governor.
Okay.
At this time, a person I know well, David Pryor, was governor. And he met, he had heard the concerns of local residents, and he talked to U.S. government officials about those concerns.
We're indicating now a population there at the peak point of some 24, and I don't think more than 25,000. But it's quite a burden to bear, but everyone there is in good spirits. I talked to Donald McDonald from the State Department this morning. He thinks things are well under control. We have representatives of the State Health Department there on the scene this morning. In fact, Dr. Rex Ramsey, the director of the State Health Department, is at Chaffee this morning, making certain that all precautions are being carried out. And
Governor David Pryor talking about what might or what would happen at Fort Chaffee. So what did happen?
Well, many of those refugees were relocated. A lot of them went to Orange County, California, and Falls Church, Virginia, as a matter of fact. But overall, the facility ended up processing more than 50,000 refugees and arranged for the resettlement here in the country. But this group, many of them were high-level officials in the South Vietnamese government. And it was a very well-organized operation. There was a newspaper that was set up. They had a radio station.
Well, when you think about the history of Chaffee, I mean, the international influence, German prisoners of war, Vietnamese refugees, and then later individuals from Cuba.
Yes, and that went very differently than the Vietnamese refugees. This was the summer of 1980, and there was the Mariel boat lift that you're familiar with, where Castro allowed 125,000 Cubans to leave the island and go to Florida, and they showed up on the shores. Unfortunately, along with good people, he released prisoners that were among these groups. And again, they had refugees housed at Fort Chaffee, and 19,000 Cubans came. It did not go the same way the Vietnamese refugee operation did. And on June 1st, 1980, there was a riot, basically. And, well, here's a report from ABC News.
About 1,000 Cubans began marching down the main post road toward the front gate. They then stormed the front gate, jumping over the fence. About 300 began pelting National Guard and state troopers with rocks, slightly injuring several men and breaking car windows. The troopers, dressed in full riot gear, rushed the Cubans, finally forcing them back onto the fort grounds. Army helicopters began circling, pleading in Spanish over loudspeakers that the Cubans calm down, and tear gas was being thrown at them.
Word from the National Guard is that the American civilians
pelted with rocks and tear gas, helicopters overhead. And the next day, yet another governor here, we're going to hear from Governor Bill Clinton, had to respond.
As you know, yesterday, substantial numbers of refugees escaped the campgrounds on two occasions, which indicated that as of yesterday, the security inside the camp was still inadequate, and that the only security actually being provided to the people of this county, and indeed to the refugees themselves in their relations with the people of this county, was being provided by the state and local law enforcement officials. General Drummond has been informed by his superiors in the Defense Department that the troops here under his command, pursuant to the efforts made by Mr. Eidenberg last night, are clearly permitted to use reasonable force.
If someone hasn't been to Chaffee, and it has changed over time. I think the first time I went was about 30 years ago, and it still had, at that point, very much the sort of stereotypical feel of a fort or a camp. There were barracks and, you know,
lots of barracks.
Yes.
I mean, rows and rows and rows of white, long barracks, yes.
And, you know, the bigger one, which would be the mess hall, and the roads, as such as they were at right angles, and it mm-hmm. had that military feel that we've seen in World War II and coming-of-age soldier movies. That would be an asset to, you know, draw some Hollywood folks here.
Oh, it makes a heck of a movie set. And as a matter of fact, it has. There have been three shot there, major movies. A Soldier Story was shot in 1984. Tuskegee Airmen, an HBO movie in 95. But I think the most famous was Neil Simon's Biloxi Blues in 1988 that starred Matthew Broderick and Christopher Walken.
Boy, it's hot. This is hot. Never got this hot in Brooklyn. This is like Africa hot. Tarzan couldn't take this kind of hot.
I'd like you to answer when your name is called. The answer to that question is ho.
Do I make myself clear, Jerome?
Ho, yes. Ho, what? Ho, nothing.
You having trouble understanding me, Jerome?
Ho, no. I mean, no ho, Sergeant.
That's a movie that was directed by Oscar winner Mike Nichols, based on a play and written by Neil Simon, who, of course, a Tony winner and famous for The Odd Couple. And I just like to think of what Christopher Walken did during his, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 weeks while he lived in Fort Smith.
Who knows?
But we can
notice Matthew Broderick talked about the heat, too.
Yeah, you're right.
He remembered that. Yeah.
Well, and Fort Chaffee, I mean, we call it that. There's a lot happening there now.
Well, yeah, I didn't realize this, but in 1995, 7,000 acres were given back to the state for development. And there is an entire community, called Chaffee Crossing, which
yep.
you're familiar with, right?
Yeah, I've been out there a few times. There's a brewery out there. And of course, before this current economic shutdown and lockdown, all sorts of more plans for what's going on there. So it's yet another mm-hmm. life that
couple
land
of
is
museums.
Having.
Yeah. So one other thing that is significant about Chaffee is that in 2005, 10,000 evacuees from Hurricane Katrina were
right.
housed there in the barracks.
Right. I know it's a cliche, but if those walls could talk, the stories, right? Well, this was fun. I like doing a place, and I think if you live in Fort Smith or the Arkansas River Valley, Fort Chaffee is something you know about. But I think there's some folks, especially new folks in Northwest Arkansas, that a lot of this will be new to them.
Check us out, Pryor Center, PRYOR. Just Google us. Go to the Pryor Center. We're adding KATV footage every day that Barbara Tyson and the Tyson Foods Foundation have donated to us to be able to digitize, and we're adding all kinds of footage. It's fun to go through.
Well, these are fun to do with you as well, Randy. And if you'll come back next Monday, we'll have you.
I'd love to. I'm working on it. I'll get the next one.
All right. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Thank you so much, Randy.
Thank you. See you next week.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
This is Ozarks at Large. With Arkansas school buildings closed because of the outbreak, education officials and Arkansas PBS continue to work to bring lessons to students' homes. In the first of two reports, Michael Hiblin with our partner station KUAR in Little Rock has more on how the program began.
It's called Alternative Methods of Instruction, or AMI.
Good morning, all you parents and students of Arkansas. I'm Randy House, and I'm a kindergarten teacher. I'm so excited you're joining me for another fun week of learning with Arkansas AMI.
House was the state's 2018 Teacher of the Year and works for the Conway School District. She and four other teachers who have been given the award in recent years host segments seen online and on television.
We have a great lineup of programs for you. And we even have a brand new math game from our math whiz, Joel Lookadoo.
Governor Asa Hutchinson ordered schools closed beginning March 17th. The AMI programming on Arkansas PBS started about 2 weeks later on the 30th. Heather Rhodes Newburn of North Little Rock is the mother of pre-K and second grade students. She says the time before the broadcasts began was a challenge.
My pre-K's assignment was very hands-on, and so working from home and being very hands-on has been a juggling act with his work, just because he's not reading all the way by himself, so you have to read the book to him, you have to sort with him. And so for that, I mean, I enjoyed it. We enjoyed the time, but it took some finagling of my schedule. And now my daughter, second grader, her assignments, the paperwork was a lot. And so when I found out about the PBS program, my sister is a teacher, and she told me about it. And so I was like, well, we'll turn it on and we'll see how it goes.
She was glad the programming was offered on broadcast TV in addition to being online.
Here at my house, we have internet connectivity issues. And so sometimes the internet's working and sometimes it's not. And so that can be very frustrating when they're required to log in to the online reading system for our school district. And so PBS was a good way to engage both of them.
Arkansas PBS already aired national educational programs during the day, but Executive Director Courtney Pledger says she and her staff wanted to do more, inspired partly by what had been done by public broadcasters in California, which was impacted by the virus about 6 weeks before Arkansas.
And we began to discuss ways of innovating that original model and making it more personal for Arkansas. And at that point, you know, we had gone to the Division of Elementary and Secondary Education and talked about the potential, and to their credit, they just, you know, leapt on the idea of developing something, and we collaborated on what it might look like and came up with a model that would be more personal, more engaging for kids by actually putting teachers on the air.
Each weekday, 5 hours of programming is aired, gearing toward pre-K to eighth grade students. Stacy Smith is Assistant Commissioner of Learning Services at the Arkansas Department of Education and helped organize the project.
It was a huge task. First off, I mean, Arkansas PBS reached out to us and basically said, hey, look, if there's a way that we can be of assistance, we want to be. And we were able to sit down and look at, you know, what were the programming options that they had to offer. So my staff at that point, we started writing. We're calling them learning opportunities by grade band.
When the virus first spread into Arkansas, students were sent home with packets of educational material originally designed for short-term challenges like snow days. But the printed material quickly ran out, and Smith says presenting material online didn't work for everyone.
We found that a lot of the state didn't have internet access to be able to access what their schools were trying to provide digitally. And we knew that a lot of districts were also sending home lots of paper packets, and there was some inconsistency. So this was an effort by the state and Arkansas PBS to collaborate, kind of provide some support for students, families, and schools.
Federal data shows that as of 2018, 23% of Arkansas households did not have internet service. But with several broadcast signals, Arkansas PBS provides coverage to about 75% of the state. In recent weeks, cable companies in the border cities of Texarkana and West Memphis also added the station to help expand its reach. Deciding what to broadcast took several rounds of back and forth, says Sajni Kampuris, Assistant Director of Education at Arkansas PBS.
We came up with this kind of format of how we were going to make this work. And fortunately, at Arkansas PBS, we have Arkansas licensed teachers on staff. So they were able to take that first phase of looking at our programs, the content of them, very meticulously to see what was appropriate for each of the grade bands. And from there, we passed what we thought would work over to the Department of Education, where they had their own educators do a second review. And then there was a third review from Stacy Smith with the Division of Elementary and Secondary Education to really make sure that we were very thoughtful and we thought about all the things that were relevant to actually the standards of learning and that there would be learning outcomes from this.
Stacy Smith with the Department of Education acknowledges that despite their best efforts with the AMI program, nothing can replicate the classroom experience.
This doesn't replace what students are missing with the face-to-face, but it does give them something. We want to be able to support families and school districts who are trying to continue this pace of learning, even though the physical building of a school is closed. And you still have teachers. They're making phone calls to parents. They may still possibly even be doing a Zoom lesson of their own, but maybe that lesson is highlighting maybe a real specific skill that the teacher needs to teach and not the parent, where the parent then is helping do reinforcement. And really, we want kids to continue to read, continue to write, continue to communicate, and continue to think critically. And that's what the learning opportunities on the PBS and Arkansas AMI guides really provide for parents.
Coming up tomorrow, a look at what might be in store in the future for alternative methods of instruction and where students may stand academically if and when schools reopen in the fall. In Little Rock, I'm Michael Heplin.
Also on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large, how Fayetteville-based Appleseeds is bringing the kitchen to third graders on Arkansas PBS this week. That's at noon and 7 tomorrow on KUAF 91.3.
Are there clathrates on Pluto? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science, and this is Scratching the Surface. Clathrates are fascinating phenomena, combining gas and solid ice. Imagine a water ice chemical compound acting like a cage, trapping inside a gaseous compound, usually methane or nitrogen. Many icy bodies in the solar system possess clathrates in some fashion, even here on Earth, usually in Alaska and Siberia. Another thing about clathrates, they could also act as insulators for subsurface oceans on icy bodies in the outer reaches of the solar system. A prime example may actually be Pluto. A recent study published in Nature Geoscience led by Kamada of Hokkaido University, Japan, takes a look at Pluto's possible oceanic secrets. Sputnik Planitia near the Plutonian equator suggests the presence of such an ocean. And at extremely cold temperatures, where everything should essentially be frozen solid, Pluto needs to retain heat in its interior somehow. The answer may actually be clathrates at the base of a thin ice shell layer and the ocean, keeping the ocean a very slushy liquid state and the frozen ice shell, well, frozen. Clathrates act as a thermal insulator. So indeed, this gives us even more questions about the state of Pluto's ocean and thermal evolution, mainly the mechanism to maintain a long-lived subsurface ocean in very minimally heated icy satellites and Kuiper Belt objects. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is produced in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas. You can find more episodes at KUAF.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Altus. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large, a production of 91.3 KUAF. Contributors to the show tonight included Antoinette Grajeda and Zuzanna Sitek. Timothy Dennis mastered our show this evening. Scratching the Surface with Caitlin Ahrens is produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. National Conversation from NPR and All Things Considered next. I'll be back tomorrow at noon with a new edition of Ozarks at Large.